This week on the show, we are interviewing ourselves in this very special Christmas episode, and we ask ourselves questions that you supplied earlier over the years to us, and we are now in the position to answer them. So stay tuned for some insights about our hobbies, all things computers, projects that we do, or anything that you never heard from us before in this week's episode of BSD Now. All right, BSD Now, episode 591, interviewing three hosts. Recorded on the 8th of December, 2024. Hi, we are your hosts, Benedikt Heuschling.
Tom Jones.
And Jason Tupner.
Aha, big surprise.
This is... all three of us here.
Yeah.
So what it is, Jason, is... I'm sure I feel Benedikt with us on the show, but I don't know. Like, so it's 16 degrees in here right now. And I tried to use my gaming PC, which runs Linux, because NVIDIA graphics, to warm up the office. And I sat there for a while. I ran like the Cyberpunk 2077 frame like benchmark for a while. It didn't help. Like, sits there, however many FPS. And I thought, okay, well, AI is meant to be heating the world up, so I'll try that. And so I installed
the world will heat up
Llama.
On its own without AI. So.
But the office is cold and. It's like -5 outside and it was 12 degrees in here, which is not like amenable to work. I can't work like that. But the stuff I'm doing for work requires like an Ethernet connection between my laptop and the test machine. And I haven't run Conduit yet. And I still haven't run Conduit to anywhere that's heated consistently. And just, yes. So I tried that. So I had OO Llama running, but it wasn't doing anything. Like NVTOP is just like, oh yeah, it's using like 60 watts. It's like, that's not good enough. Like I need more. And so
more power.
I ran OpenSSL multi on all cores, GLMark, and I was just asking, like I told OO Llama that it was a sentient room and I gave it opinions and it just couldn't settle down. Like it was poisonously Americanly optimistic. Like, I don't know if you've like seen the toxic optimism that comes out of these things. It's like, oh, what a great temperature. Like, it's not a great temperature. It's really cold. I'm like, okay, AI model, a suitable room temperature is 18 degrees. It's 15 degrees in here. Oh, a bit chilly, but it's nice and refreshing. I'm like, no, stop it. Like,
yeah, you need to tell it to be less optimal or optimization or a positive.
You need AI models written by dour Scottish people. They'd be much better. Like, then the model would be like, what are you doing working here? Go home.
Well, it might be like the language, you know, on your dictionary for your spell check and that sort of stuff. You have a locale that's perfect for you.
A Scots locale for my LLM. What I could do is tell it that it has to filter everything through like a pessimism filter. But I don't think it'll work.
Teach it to be like that. I mean, this is the flexibility they have.
Can you? I mean, I told it that a good load average was like a high load average was above 12. And a reasonable load average was like above 8 on the 16 core machine. And like, so anything below that would be like kind of idle.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, load average is 9. It went, oh, that's not too busy. Load average is 9. Oh, I'm overloaded. I'm like, what? Like pick one. Where are you? I told you how to think. As a heater, it didn't work.
Well, you should have just got Poudre out and just built the whole ports tree and then just put a loop.
So I was in the attic. So I finally ran Conduit from the office to the attic, which after a lot, like, no one listening to this is going to do this, but like after hours of debugging the house, I figured out that the attic is a meter away from the office because there's like a mezzanine floor and the attic is above the mezzanine floor where the bathroom is. And so the floor of the attic is 75 centimeters above the floor of the office, which completely threw me off. There's a hole drilled in the wall, like 2.5 meters above the floor here, which did not go anywhere. It's just in the roof. And so I thought, I managed to run this. Like it took two of us. We did like four plans. We figured out where everything is. It's like 1 meter away in a straight line. So I run Conduit. So I was in the attic, like moving the test bed around, making something ridiculous, which hopefully will be a EuroBSD con talk, but we'll see. And it was really warm there. And it was just like my two build machines running. And they're the same computer. Like I just have three of the same computer. So I don't understand why the NVIDIA graphics card couldn't warm up the office, but the machines without graphics card could warm up the attic. But yeah, I was expecting to get 500 watts of heat out of this computer and I'm just not. And I'm disappointed. It's meant to be power hungry.
Okay, welcome to our Christmas episode, everyone. We thought we would do something special, like it was either last year or the year before where we collected.
No, it was last year.
Last year? Okay.
Yeah, and we had a heap of questions, and we didn't get through them all.
So that's why we're doing them now, the remaining ones, and we thought we would answer all of them since we're three hosts, so why not go through them at this point? So
I'll kick off.
Yeah, go ahead.
What is the one what-if scenario in tech history that you're most fascinated about?
Didn't we do this last year?
Didn't
we talk about the continuation of Sun?
No, I think we didn't get to that one.
Did we not? Did we just?
It was in the list of questions, but I don't recall answering that.
But I had this right, because so TCP should have a length field in the header, like that would solve all the problems with TCP. Then we could do trailing data. And I'm sure I talked about this. Like I got like 40 minutes prepared on this. I've had it for years.
So my what if tech scenarios would be, what would have happened if Apple, who was very tight on money, actually did get bankrupt and Steve Jobs didn't get there in time to save it?
But they weren't tight on money.
Well, they were when he
the saying was, we are 90 days from bankruptcy, but yeah. That was to do with the channel model. That was to do with the channel model, like how they actually pushed hardware out. It came out on Hacker News last week. There was a report from somebody who went to WWDC in 1997, and it was all about Rhapsody, which was the code name for what became Mac OS X. And one of the things in the article was they said in some session that they have, you know, $1 billion in the bank, so they have a lot of cash so they can invest. But they're also like a big machine. So I don't know, like the underdog story around Apple is really interesting. And if you want to know more, you should listen to Mac Folklore Radio, which just reads old magazine articles about the development of the Mac, and a lot of stuff is in this period. But I don't know how cash strapped they were. One thing they did say is that Mac OS, the old Mac OS, like Mac OS 7, when they were working on Copeland, was down to three developers, like three people working on a whole operating system, and that it was ramped back up to 100 developers. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what would have happened. Like, they could have sold off Apple. One of the things covered in Mac Folklore Radio is the reality behind the situation. So we have this notion that BOS would have been the platform that carried away, because Jean-Louis Gasset is really good at talking. But Jean-Louis Gasset has said afterwards, like in Computer History Museum talks, that BOS wasn't really there. Like, it was a cool toy, but it wasn't the stability of a Unix platform that Apple came in. Like, Apple managed to inherit a lot of stuff by taking Muck and BSD, and like they got a lot of stuff together for free.
That's my, like, the whole trickle down effect. Like, Apple is not there, what happened to LLVM and free BSD and such? So that's, and developers, like, of course.
And an interesting one would be like, what if Next had been successful? Like, so, like if Next had some level success, would they have had a some level failure?
Like that 15 years also, later? Or would have Microsoft like taken over the world even more than it already did? With there was no Apple to kind of be the, you know, opposite of that. So that's, it's a horror scenario in certain ways, but it's also like, is there an alternative or another company who would have gotten into this space?
So this year I read Programming the AT386 by Crawford and Gelsinger, which is amazingly apropos for this week when Gelsinger was fired. And I was offended, like physically offended reading about the segmented memory model. Like, why were they doing this? Okay, the book's from 1984. Things weren't that bad then. This is like an awful thing. I can't believe people programmed about it. It really explained to me why everyone hates the PC so much and Intel. Like, I'd be annoyed at Intel if I had to write 16-bit assembly to start a 32-bit operating system. But I think the success of the PC pushed everything out, because the PC was super cheap, because the only way to get people to use something so compromised was for it to be incredibly cheap. And I don't see any future where Next succeeds. I don't see any future where anyone succeeds other than like a white box vendor. And the only way that ARM managed to take over in the way it has is because stuff was incredibly cheap and people were annoyed with Intel.
And cheap and power efficient.
All the stuff on the board, like you look back at the first IBM, right? And it was all off-the-shelf parts. So Intel, that's how Intel got its break. And there was really the only bit of proprietary stuff that IBM put on there was the BIOS, and that was it. Everything else was off the shelf. So that's why it became an open architecture and you know, took off. Everything else had to be designed from the ground up, apart from the CPU. So your Z80 or your 6502. But that was back in the 8-bit era.
Yeah,
probably before your time, Tom.
Yeah, long before my time. I just can't see any timeline where expensive Unix wins, like expensive platforms. And so
proprietary Unix?
Yeah, like proprietary Unix obviously was, maybe not obviously, but very clear now looking back why this failed. Why would you pay for proprietary Unix, which was slow and not innovating, when you could get new stuff for free with a bit of work? And there's like an education model for how people get to use stuff. Like, people aren't born inherently using a computer, not yet at least, but they learn things and people gravitate towards, like, some people want to go really institutionalized, and that's why we still have Windows PC developers. But a lot of people want to be the underdog and they want to do something scrappy and they want to come through. And that's to our benefit, right? As BSD enthusiasts, we are the scrappy underdog platform. And how is that going to compete, right? Like, people still love the Amiga, as it was a scrappy underdog platform with lots of benefits you could talk about and lots of downsides which you could ignore. And you could do that with Linux and you could do it with BSD. And how was Alteryx going to compete with that? Or HPUX or AUX? Like, how is any of these platforms going to compete with people, with a platform people had fun using?
Those platforms, so I'll look at it a different way, because I actually worked with all those platforms through the 90s. So I was a back VMS alpha person. I also did Sun, and then in the early 2000s I did a bit of HPUX, but they all had their purpose and they all worked well. So in organizations and big business, they were the perfect decision, because you look back at what PCs were back then, they were absolute garbage. When I was working doing PC support but also doing VMS stuff, the VAC system that we had that was doing all the just-in-time manufacturing process from, you know, in engineers put their stuff in and, you know, handles materials, goods in, goods and make goods outwards and that sort of stuff. That VAC box was just, you just couldn't imagine the 486 that you were also working on at a desk across from it could ever actually do that. You know, the Pentium gave us a glimpse, you know, the Pentium 90, when it first came about, gave us a glimpse of what was the potential for the open architecture, but it still took another, 15 years before it was realized in cloud computing and that sort of stuff, that actually got to a point where it was a option that you would choose to run your platform, your business on, really.
But I think the issue with these big Unix platforms was that they're expensive. And they were good because they were expensive, because they could put in engineering time, but it also ossified them quite a bit. And it's much easier for people to come and find something which is fun, right? Like, I have too many Intel computers sat next to me, and I couldn't fit that many VAX machines next to me. And there would never have been an economy of scale which would allow them to give me like a disposable thin client style computer running VMS. I mean, Spark did some of the, Sun did some of this, but the Sun stuff was really expensive and it was a full ecosystem, whereas these are basically disposable things. And you know, you get the kids involved, which is very funny for me to say as the youngest member of this team, but like, you get the kids involved and they're going to do the fun, exciting stuff, and that's a really hard thing to compete with.
I've got one of these that I'll put to you guys. It's what is most fascinated about was, I was a big Sun, and I still am a big Sun fanboy. So that's what I cut my teeth with in the Unix space. But what would have happened if IBM got Sun and not Oracle?
Oh yeah. And they were also, I mean, pushing their weight around, like, as a big company with a lot of money and market share.
For IBM to have bought Sun, they probably wouldn't have done the investment in Red Hat, because they bought they bought a Unix platform that way, right? They bought Linux. So does Linux have to go away for IBM to buy Sun?
well, not Linux cool, wasn't around. Linux wasn't around then, so I think it was 2008 was the acquisition of Sun.
Or it didn't have the maturity to be a contender for Sun.
But you know, so IBM invested a lot of money in Red Hat in 1995. Like they were a big proponent behind. Like I have this theory that Linux is an IBM project. I don't want to do the research to figure this out because if I'm right, it's just sad. But you know, IBM put a lot of money into Linux. Like they put a lot of financial support in because it's a very dynamic platform and it's easy. Like the money is basically easy, right? Like it's not a lot of money. Like a lot of money into Linux is nothing to IBM. It's not one supercomputer's worth of money. If IBM bought Sun, my only reputation, only things I know about IBM are from reputation from people who worked there previously in old jobs. And they just talked about a terrible outsourcing culture where they would do insourcing. Like so in the UK, they do insourcing. So they would move projects to IBM and IBM would run the project badly for 6 months to a year and then suggest outsourcing it to India and stuff would outsource and then be brought back and then have like a four times as long development cycle fixing all the outsourced stuff. And I don't know how, like that would have worked for Sun, right? Would they've, there was a lot of Sun development done, you know, outside the US. It wasn't like a complete monoculture.
It was really more engineering project, driven, as far as I understand it, that Sun was a bit more.
But that that breaks an engineering organization, right? Like these sorts of projects were things where there'd be a development team and then there'd be a maintenance team and they're completely separate people who never met. And so why bother doing good engineering if you never have to look after it? That's the whole premise of DevOps. And why would you ever expect to get any time to do good maintenance if you didn't do the development? Because you weren't respected enough to do that. Because the maintenance team is definitely paid a lot less than the development team. So I don't know if that. I think there would have still been the diaspora from Sun. Like everyone left, right? Everyone with any self-respect left, and they went and did other things. And I think it would have happened again. I don't know many people who would be happy working for Big Blue just off reputation.
Do you think Big Blue would have left Sun as an isolated business like they did with Red Hat?
Like the full acquisition of Red Hat happens much later where they have a much better name. And, you know, 2008, that's a really different world. Like nobody cared about open source then. It was still, you know, a sneaker thing. There was still Microsoft saying Linux is a cancer. So it's hard to say. Would they've just open sourced all of it? I don't know. It's an interesting one.
It's interesting to look at it in hindsight, like what would have happened. And of course, many of these timelines didn't appear in a parallel universe only. But a lot of these things are like crucial milestones in the IT history. And it could have gotten completely different.
I don't know what the history of, like, I don't know what IBM as a company was like after the failure of the PC. I mean, successful failure of the PC. So the history of IBM is really well documented around the Microsoft deal. Like, it's very clear. There's all these Microsoft people talked about it a lot. There's a lot of history around OS2. But then after then, I don't really like IBM got much quieter in the consumer tech industry because they
sort of departed it. Robert X. Gringely covers the history of IBM quite well and easy to digest for the regular people. If you were ever curious, he did a couple of movie length part one and part two, which crosses over into the Apple space and all that sort of stuff. So it's sort of the late last millennium. The sort of the wars in the personal computer era. It's good.
Okay. Food for thought.
Yeah, it's one we could actually sit there all day talking about that. Maybe we should one day. And we sort of did that around dinner at EuroBSDCon. We missed you, Tom. Where was you at Euro? Well, I suppose you're dad now. So
yeah, I was. I don't know. I genuinely no idea. Was it September? I was probably actually working. Catching up for all the not working.
Well, bringing up working, that brings us a good segue to our next question is, if you weren't working in IT, what would you like to do for a career? Silence.
That's, yeah. Thinking now, silence.
I've sort of mulled over this. It's like, if I get the shits one day and just go, I've had enough with IT, what would I want to do? And I'd probably want to be an electrician.
Oh.
I think we did these questions 3 years ago, because I've answered this question. Because my response the last time was, I was offered a job as a cow farmer, like the week before, and I didn't take it. I think we did this in 2021.
I went and listened to, I went and listened to last year's one. So unless last year's questions were recycled from the previous one. we have JT to answer for these, but I did come up with some other ones. If I was an electrician, and if I was to exit IT now, I'd probably work at Bunnings, which is like a hardware chain over here, or be a bus driver.
To sell that? Yeah.
Okay. Be a bus driver. Huh. I wouldn't be a bus driver. You have to speak around to people all the time.
The route's always the same, but you get around.
You'd be the bus driver that just takes the buses home. My dad does that. Huh. I don't know.
Where to park a bus here.
Education.
The thing I say to everyone is, don't pick a career that requires your knees to work, because, like, I'm not that old, but my knees aren't great. And having tried a career which was very hard on my knees, I do regret it. Maybe a train driver would be fun. Like a mechanic of some sort would be quite fun. Yeah. I like the problem solving part of doing this.
Yeah, a little bit of engineering you can't go without.
I think electrician's much better than plumber, but both of them require being in very dirty places all the time, dealing with stressful
dark
people.
Dark and dirty, yeah.
Well, that's when you become a manager really fast. You know, you get your certificate and that sort of stuff. And if you're old enough, then you know the state of play, so you can sort of build a business on that, and then you just have all the apprentices do the work.
Have an office job again. Them.
Yeah.
I think if I had to have a different career, I'd maybe pick like landed gentry. That'd be good. I could just sit at home all day reading. It's not really a career, but peer in the House of Lords, hereditary peer. That'd be good.
Ooh, wow.
Really evil jobs where you don't really have to do anything. You can get away with a lot.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I could cope with the ramifications that come with it. So
and it's like,
I'm
so many
sure.
Jobs are IT anyway now. Like, if you went to be, sorry, Benedict, to cut you off, but if you're like, I would want to go and install radio antennas and radio masts, you still probably have to use a computer all the time for that, know all the IT stuff.
Yeah, like the pervasiveness of IT, that's certainly everywhere. But have you done some social stuff? Like where you do work with people instead of machines?
Well, being a bus driver, you gotta have that people skills.
Yeah,
because
that too. And computer people are not good in this area.
Oh, totally off topic, but still talking about buses. Like, I was on a bus at Dublin, right? So I was on my way to the hotel from the airport, and it's late at night and that sort of stuff. And then some people tried to get on the bus the wrong way because they didn't want to pay. And so the bus driver goes, get off. And then he just shuts the power down on the bus. And this big guy, I mean, he was like 6'8", red hair. It's like, I don't want to meet you in a dark alley, dude. And he goes, mate, you just got to get off the bus. You and your missus, get off the bus now. And they got off the bus. And we continued on that way. It was great.
He doesn't care about this time schedule where the buses should arrive and leave.
Yeah, I'm sitting there going, yeah, action.
So why bus instead of taxi?
Oh, you don't need a taxi driver.
Because taxis were flexible where you go, right?
Yeah, but taxi drivers are horrible people.
No, taxis are shit job, Eric.
Okay.
Yeah, offense to everyone.
Just exploring a space where we could,
If you look at it's going to be controversial. If you look at the sort of jobs, Benedict, that people can do, people that pick jobs where they're their own boss and can never be fired and are not can never be held accountable for what they say, they're not like great people to know. But you might get some banter out of a taxi driver, but you can get some really horrible things out of a taxi driver. Like, there's some really horrible stuff.
Are you the one who asks the taxi drivers every time, like, what they would do with a million
dollars? Oh, yeah. So I used to play this game where I'd see how long it took a taxi driver to be racist, but it was just sad. Like, literally the end of my road. And I was like, this is just not worth it. No, it's not fun anymore.
Okay.
So I asked the taxi driver what he would do if he won the lottery, and he managed to turn that into a racist story in 4 minutes. And it was a 7-minute taxi journey to the airport. Like, I don't know how he did it. I was genuinely perplexed at how he did this. I was like, I was looking for the positive things, but it didn't work.
It's the amount of ranty radio they listen to all day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah. That's taxing.
we don't really have that in the UK though. So I don't know how it worked.
What, you don't have ranty radio over there? You don't have
not so
drops.
Much. No. like a little bit, but it's not like very PC. It's not like the BBC.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Did you get some good answers from that million or lottery question?
I got not from that question, but I got a wonderful story from a taxi driver. He told me that him and his wife booked this package holiday to Corfu, and it was like really cheap, and he was really happy about it. And they got there, and it was during a leather festival, and it was very disconcerting for him. He had not had this experience in global culture before. But he went to some bars, and everyone was really nice. He had a great time. And I was like, what? This is a taxi driver? This is an incredible world view. I've never had this before. So yeah, best taxi driver I ever had. But of course, you never see them again.
Yeah. I just wonder how taxi drivers react to other taxi drivers when they're in a foreign country or have to go somewhere. Like, are they their worst customers or like totally understanding about the job? Well, yeah, I'm still missing.
I just process that, actually.
Like,
my head is just like,
I would have driven the other way. Well, yeah. So I'm not sure. I would probably be in office and do some like paperwork or something.
Do you do boring. What you do now?
I do that. Yeah, in education, it's a little less paperwork. It's more, you know.
I would also use spreadsheets, but the spreadsheets wouldn't be fun.
Yeah. Just the ordering process is just awful that we have.
I think you should be a store manager for a large institution, like a railway or a bank or a government department.
Oh,
the person standing behind the counter saying, sorry, mate, it's a store. We're not meant to give things out. It's for storing things.
Yeah, but I did that for a while, selling computer hardware. But yeah, you need the people skills and also the sales
I don't mean like selling things. I mean, like, there's a big warehouse of stuff. You're in charge for stock keeping and inventory and not giving things to people. If they have the right paperwork, you give them stuff, but you don't need people skills. You just need to be like, I guess you need people skills so you can get stuff from other stores you're meant to get, but just basically be like, no, man, I'm not issuing you that. Yeah. You don't have the right form. That'd be great. That'd be a fun job. Well, not for anyone involved.
It's definitely not going to get boring anytime soon.
I'd quite like a job where I could just sit and read and not do any work.
Then you could be some kind of, you know, I don't know, like, what are these people called that just sit there and wait for people to come in? Like
a receptionist.
Yeah, like these. They have a lot of, or like in a hotel even, you have some time where you have to work, and then in the evening or at night,
the problem with these jobs, Benedict, is people invent work for you to do, because...
Yeah, they get a lot of reading time.
I don't think that's real.
Not get insane.
You'd work well in the army, TJ. It's like you could be working as a quartermaster in the
store. It's almost like I was describing a quartermaster, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, your paperwork doesn't line up, mate. Sorry, go away.
Okay. Well, that was a good insight into our own personality right there.
Right. I don't know what this next question was supposed to be about. So, most beautiful place on the planet you've been to, in your opinion?
As opposed to someone else's opinion of the places I've been.
Well, everybody has their own opinion, I suppose. So that's opinion, I suppose.
based on Yelp reviews, the most beautiful place I've been is.
Go to that place instead of the other.
I mean, honestly, based on Instagram, it's probably that tree in New Zealand that's in a lake. I can't remember what it's called. Let me Google it. It'll take a second. Tree in a lake, New Zealand. Wanaka Willow. There we go. See? Search engines still work. Yeah, based on like Instagram views, is definitely the one. It's a tree in a lake. It was my desktop background for ages. And I was always like, no one ever says nice things about my desktop background. And I've learned that no one ever says anything about anyone's desktop background. But it's because the photo I took, which was really good, looks like 400,000 other photos that people have taken of this very picturesque tree. No, I'm not going to say that. I don't know. Somewhere in Scotland. It's like, I think a lot of the beauty of a place is about situation. Like it's the experience and the environment around you. And I definitely had a nicer time just sitting in a forest, listening to birds than any place which would be called, which would be, you know, Instagram like rated. Like I've been to Iceland, I've been to New Zealand, I've traveled a lot, I've been to loads of really picturesque places, but a lot of those are really tired and you're hungry and you're wondering where a bathroom is and you've just walked up a really big hill and they're not great. And instead the better things are like cycling down a road early in the morning and chasing pheasants away. Like that was probably one of the most beautiful experiences I've had. Like it was wonderful. Deer running alongside me wondering if they were going to kill me. I think they didn't, so I got away with it. But you know, when you see 60 deer running along the side of the road while you're cycling, you do start sort of panic. You're like, if any of these deer turn right, I'm in a lot of trouble. But that was a great experience.
I do like watching a lot of YouTube of Scottish bikepacking. So there's a fair bit on YouTube for adventure bike riding over there. And yeah, some of the scenes are just pretty magical.
I quite like watching Bo Miles documentaries. Is an Aussie runner and scrap dealer. No, he likes to pick up wood and rubbish from like the side of the road. And he does a lot of ultra marathons, and seeing running in the Aussie bush is amazing. Like,
you two should just switch places for a while, and then
I think in the UK we have this view of Australia as like Mad Max, like the first Mad Max film, where it's like a desert, like the outback is a desert because you hear about people dying in the outback all the time. And you're like, yeah, there's no water, they just die. And seeing the outback is like forests and a rugged landscape is really nice to see.
Yeah, we have it here. We have it all here. Like with our alpines, nothing like European alpines. But you know, you can be in one state where it's snowing, and then basically fly, because it would take you 3 or 4 days to drive to another state where it's stinking bloody hot. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we all say this about our own homes because we love our own homes. But you know, the Australian outback, the reds in the dirt are just absolutely mind-blowing. It's, you know, you go and chase those red roads and it's just, you know, it's beautiful, but the stuff gets everywhere. That dust, you find it for years afterwards. But you know, the Australian landscape is beautiful here. It's just like, it's so big that even somebody that's lived here their whole entire life will never see the whole lot from top to toe. It's just no way. One of my favorite ones is hearing tourists say, oh yeah, I'll find the Cairns and then I'll get a hire car and I'll drive to Melbourne. And it's just like, yeah, nah, that's not going to happen. You know, that's 3,500 kilometers.
It looks a bit shorter on the map, yeah. But in reality, it's a lot bigger, yeah.
That's really far. That's like a long way. You can say that about Iceland, though, and you can say that about New Zealand. Like, I drove the entire ring road of Iceland. It's only 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, that's doable.
It's great. Like, it was a wonderful week. And I drove north to south of New Zealand, and that was only a couple of weeks. Like, that was fine. I mean, it's only the size of the UK.
And I hear you could go there in a different season, like summer, winter, and it's a totally different country every time.
I think South Island is probably always quite similar. There's probably always a lot of insects that bite you.
Yeah, if you prefer that. So my pick would be Lake Louise, where I've been to with my brother. Oh, it must have been 10 years ago by now. So that was just great. This like mountainous area, a lot of wood, and this clear, quiet lake there. Of course, it's touristy, but we also have woods and lakes and trees in Germany, but not in this size and this scale of like pure nature, nothing else around. That was certainly majestic and impressive. So yeah, Canada. Woo!
Yes, Canada is nice. I do enjoy Vancouver. Vancouver's a really nice spot.
Yeah, it's also interesting. I should go there one more time to visit some places I haven't been to.
I'm sure I told this in the podcast. So we were BSD Canada 2023 and we went to Quebec. And then we just like a taxi driver, a way to go to Quebec. And we went to Pink Lake and we got there, like we took a taxi somewhere to like some ranger station or whatever. And then we walked there and it was like a 10K walk and we got to this lake and it was beautiful. It was a really hot day. We saw beavers on the way. It was wonderful. And then we realized there was no way to get back to where we'd come from. It was impossible. The roads were closed to cars and people were cycling and it was a great place to cycle. But then we had to walk like 8 kilometers to get to anywhere we could get a bus. And then we couldn't get on the bus because the buses would not take card payment. So we had to go and find an ATM. And it was just like this horrible adventure in Quebec.
Definitely memorable.
Picturesque, but not memorable for a good reason. I mean, it was a nice thing to do before we were married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a memory you both cherish. We got back from there.
Survived.
Still together. Okay, next question is, what is the first version of each of the BSDs you've installed on your own hardware? So we might have answered this when we first all started on the show at some point, but there's probably new listeners out there that haven't heard our foray into the BSDs and how we got to where we are now. So open with you, Benedict.
So why was the infamous, I didn't know at the time, version 5.2.1. So if you have a 2.1 release, there's always something off there. But that was my introduction to BSD. And yeah, that what I ran. I installed it and got my feet wet with that system. And yeah, upgraded from there, of course. But then afterwards, I hear, people shouldn't have run 5.2.1, which is, they had some horrible things in there. But as a beginner, I didn't go there, or it didn't influence me, or I had no problems using the system. So otherwise I wouldn't have stayed with the BSD. So 5.2.1.
The 5 tree sort of had a pretty bad reputation.
Multi-threading.
Yeah. When was that? That was what, 99, 2000 or something like that?
Around that time, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
And it was interesting enough to not, throw me off or say, let's go back to Linux or somewhere. It certainly had its things that are new, but they weren't like impossible to solve with some research or with books. And I definitely wouldn't have been there if I hadn't started with one free BSD. I mean, I could have used the release before or after, which would probably have a similar experience. But yeah, that was my very first BSD release that I vividly recall.
Mine was OpenBSD 2.8 was my first foray into the BSDs. What was I doing? I was screwing around with Linux at the time, building XFS, because, file systems have always been a joke on Linux, still are. That'll probably get some hate mail, but
like always.
If you think that I'm wrong to say that, Linux file systems are a joke, still in 2024, send your email into feedback@bsdnow.tv and let me know why I'm wrong, because I think they still are a bit of a joke. I was given a set of OpenBSD CDs. There was a Canadian guy that I was working with over in Hong Kong, and he said, stop screwing around with that toy operating system and have a go at this. And then I started using it. I go, well, this is comprehensively documented. It was like, having man pages is golden. Whereas I think I was screwing around with Zuse Linux at the time, and at least they came with big ass manuals. Big ones.
I remember those as a German distro. They had always a big pile of documentation with them.
Yeah,
in the box.
At least you could work with that, but it's like carrying manuals around is a bit of a joke. But OpenBSD was well documented. So I started using that. And there was some software that I sort of was using that, because I had one other job back in Sydney when I was working there, had to build a new firewall. So, but they required a GUI firewall. So FW Builder was around at that point in time. It allowed you to build firewall rule policies using graphical interface, which is really, really cool. So yeah, that's how I got started with the BSDs. And yeah, FreeBSD came not long after that, because I needed some other hardware that wasn't supported in OpenBSD. But I'm pragmatic with what I use. Basically, whatever problem, I'll pick the right tool for the job.
I have to answer the next question with this question, because they come like intrinsically linked. So anyone can roll into that. So the next question is, how old were you? I'm not going to tell you that. When you got your first computer, and what was that computer? I'm not going to tell you how old I was, because it's just going to upset Benedict and Jason.
It asks about the age as well.
That's such a great question. I was however many years old. my first computer was Apple iBook G4, which I got just before the Intel MacBooks as a terrible purchase. So apparently the Intel MacBooks came out in 2006. So I guess I got this in 2006. So I got to pay full price for a computer that was obsolete immediately. But what did I know? I was however old I was. And I think I ran that for like a year and then maybe 6 months. And I got books from the library, which should age this quite well. And I wanted to learn Unix. And I definitely got a ton of books in the library, which I never read. But I read some of like Learn Unix in 24 Hours or like a similar book like that. And all of the tools in this Unix book were pretty different from the tools on the MacBook. And so I started installing Linux to get closer to the tools in the Unix book, which is like the deepest irony possible. Like, because the Mac was a Unix and Linux definitely wasn't. And so I think the first Linux distribution I installed on that MacBook was Ubuntu 24.06.04, like something like that, 2006, which I got on CD. But I got it on CD for free from Canonical, like long after I installed it, because I just burned a CD. Anyway, I got a free CD. And then on that computer, I installed OpenBSD. And looking at just the release timelines, I probably had OpenBSD on there in like OpenBSD 4.1 or 4.2. And maybe I ran current because support would have been better. I also ran a Slackware distribution called Slackintosh, which had the best support for the PowerPC like iBook possible. Like everything worked really well. Suspend worked great. The trackpad worked, which it didn't work in Ubuntu, even though they had a PowerPC distribution. And then I think I installed FreeBSD 7 current, but FreeBSD's power support was never very good, still okay. And so things didn't work on that. Was like the keyboard didn't work, because there was no drivers for the keyboard.
It's kind of useful to have.
I bought my first USB keyboard to use with this computer and mouse, so I could type, but it was pretty useless. Like it wasn't even possible to get to a desktop or have Wi-Fi. Through that, like it was a hard time for open source software. Like I had to use the BCM43XX driver and build my own custom kernels to have Wi-Fi work, which yeah, it definitely led me down a path of doing stuff with computers, because I was a real like shock. Like nothing works. You got to figure this all out. And I think at that age, it was a perfect like activity for me to do. Like I can't think of any other way I would have been exposed to stuff. And I think I just installed things constantly on this. I remember installing Gentoo on it, like a stage two. So I had to compile almost everything apart from like a boot image. That was great fun. Like
yeah,
great
back computer. In the day with the instructions.
And the G4 wasn't exactly a powerhouse when it came to building code either.
No, it wasn't. And I got this computer so I could have my own computer. And then I ended up sitting at the modem where the family computer was, because that was the only way I could get on the internet, because we, one, didn't have Wi-Fi, and two, Wi-Fi didn't work. So like it was just impossible. But yeah, it was great fun.
Okay. So I
had one of those MacBooks. It wasn't a silly purchase. I bought one. I used it for years until the hard drive eventually crapped out, and I just go, "Oh, it's not worth the amount of power that it pulls." So I binned it.
It was only a silly purchase because, like, a month or two later, the polycarbonate MacBooks were released.
You didn't know back then that this would happen.
I didn't know anything about computers. And that could have run Windows through Bootcamp. It would have been a much more useful computer, and it could run virtually.
This was your first computer. You wanted to have computer. At least one kind of computer to start with, and you don't care what the current thing is.
I didn't know anything about computers. Yeah, it was my first computer.
You had
like,
at least
I just,
a computer.
Like, I had to advocate for this, but it was really funny because I read like lots of Mac user magazines when I got it, because I got this first computer, and they were all talking about the new i386 stuff, and I definitely missed out on the ability to do like really bad virtualization, which would have been a great learning environment, because I could have run computers on my computer without hosing my computer. But whatever, I just host my computer constantly.
Okay.
What about you, Benedict? How old were you?
Hard to tell, but it was a 386 DX40 where you could press the power button to put it down to 20 hertz or something.
I have one of those here.
In like a little tower.
That's a proper 32-bit one too.
The
pretend SX stuff.
So that was DOS era, what it mostly ran games. So we had a friend who had a 486, and that was definitely better for like better games and some of those games didn't even run on my computer. But that's how I learned DOS and, you know, copy and, you know, how to use a floppy disk and stuff like that. And then went on the Windows route with the next computer was a Pentium 90, I think. Or no, Pentium 133 at that time. And then we did like Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 and stuff. But the Unix route, I didn't start until I got to the university where I got introduced to Linux and Unix environments. So that was a hard cut there. But the first, very first computer was a 386 DX40.
I got a split timeline here because is it your family computer or is it your computer? So the family computer was back in 1985. And it was a Amstrad PCW 8256, which was more of a word processing computer, but it did like a script and all that sort of stuff. You can boot CPM and things like that. But that lasted for a whole year. And then I got my own Amstrad CPC 6128. And, you know, that was a Z80 CPU with a big 4 megahertz of raw performance. It certainly taught you how to do some, programming concepts and use hardware wisely, unlike developers today. Meaning using hardware wisely is you had really only, unless you started doing assembly and doing peaks and pokes and that sort of stuff, you really only had access to the first 64K of RAM, 64 kilobytes of RAM. So you try and make, you know, your code and the data you're working with fit with inside that realm. You sort of learn to different concepts that are in use today. So that was my first computer. So, but, you know, my first PC was back in 91, and it was a 286 AT. With 1 meg of RAM and a 40 megabyte hard drive that you had to park. You know, you had the utility to park the heads because otherwise, you know, the heads don't retract from the disk unless you actually tell it to. These days, you know, there's all that intelligence inside the disk. You don't have to worry about it. But back in those days, it was you run the machine. You're the owner of the machine. You run the machine. It's not going to think for you. But I'm showing my age, aren't I, amongst you too?
Oh. Yeah, interesting. Like where you all start from and how it went, how it goes, how it's still today. I mean, at one point you start not taking track or making, you know, a whole lot of records. Oh, what was that computer 2 years ago or 3 years ago? You have so many over your lifetime that you don't recall.
I've got them all in a text file.
Oh, you like a history file?
Yeah, I've got all of them. I mean, how do I...
With like specs and hardware?
I don't know about specs and hardware, but...
I don't think machines have as much soul or character these days as they used to have. So I also had an Amiga 600 after my 286. I've just gone, this is still a pile of rubbish. And I went and got an Amiga 600 because it had the same size hard drive. It had double the RAM, but it could do proper multitasking. Whereas all the IBM compatible machines at the time, you know, even with Desk View and that sort of stuff, and Windows didn't multitask. And it's like, you know, Windows 95 was not even on the scene at this point, and that still couldn't multitask. That was still just DOS with a GUI on top of it. So, you know, the Amiga just was like brilliant. You'd be on a bulletin board doing all your FidoNet stuff and that sort of thing, and then you're listening to mod files over here, and you're doing all this, and it seamlessly did it without any fuss. And it was just like, you know, even today you see, you know, processes that make a machine jitter and that sort of stuff, and machines just don't handle load as well as the Amiga seemed to do. And even with the Amiga not running protected memory and stuff like that, still seemed to manage and stay up all right. But I suppose it was still only a single user machine and it wasn't have a network stack. So
I have here, Benedict, a text file that I wrote. I don't know, I'd have to leave the text file to find out. And it's got like, it's titled Every Computer I Can Remember. And then it's got every computer I had when I wrote it. And then historically in order, iBook G4, Triple E PC 701, ThinkPad something the university gave me, a Compaq something, I can't remember what it was, 2010 MacBook Air, iPad from whenever, Nexus 7, iPad mini, X220 tablet, MacBook Pro 2012, D1 Black, Onion Omega 2, the chip from Pocket Computers, MacBook Air 2012, Pinebook 11, Acer C720, a CompuSec and X5 box, a USB Armory. They were when I wrote this, but I've got a host names file in my wiki. Because every machine gets a host name, because I think they do have
its own unique JSON. Name. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not their own unique name, because I really like some of them. So I looked for ages, like, you know, naming things is one of the hardest things in computer science. I looked ages for a naming scheme for computers, and I love the Culture series of books by Ian Banks. And so I used ships from the Culture series of books for host names for computers. One, because they're really funny, and two, because there's like 250 of them. How many are there? There's 194 of them, which should be enough for every computer I have for quite a long time.
Yeah, without running out of names.
And so I have all of these from December 2015 is when I started doing this. So I've just, like, when I pick a host name, I go through the list, find something which I haven't used, which I like, and then use it. And the worst one was I had a virtual machine for this, and I was ravished by the sheer implausibility of that last statement, which is just pushing up to the practical limits for DNS. So I have quite a big list of all the computers.
Okay.
I don't think it would be that hard to do. I mean, maybe now you call them soulless JSON, it'd be harder. But I think for the older stuff, you could probably do some autobiography and figure out every computer you had. I guess work computers are harder, but what do you pick? I mean, work desktops have all been pretty dull anyway.
Yeah, okay. So you keep the history better than I do.
You touched on wikis, Tom. What wiki software are you using?
This is Vim Wiki, which is a plugin for Vim, which gives you a markdown-based wiki in Vim. I said it's in Vim.
Wow.
So that's what I use for personal wiki. And I have like an alias which moves into a directory and opens it, and then it does an automatic git commit and pushes it. So it's backed up, but it's pushed to this machine it's on. And it works fine for old notes. I would like something better than this. I mean, I said before when we were talking about show planning, but I've been using Notion for like a personal log. And I'm using Notion because it lets me have a calendar I can click on. And that's like the genuinely is just the slimmest view. Like, I just want to add notes to a calendar so I can remember what I did on a day and look at stuff based on a calendar so I can figure out what I did last week.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people are doing this note-taking thing now more like really precise with like colors and design and what did I do when, like a personal diary of sorts, but also
everyone needs
like
a hobby.
Note-taking from books and stuff.
How about you, Jason? What do you use for tracking your notes or...
Pen and paper?
No, pen and just still
write notes?
For tracking my notes, I mean, I showed Benedict this in the last show. I take an A4 piece of paper and I fold it in half, and then I just write on it. And then I throw it away because the notes are about, like, the writing of notes is about most of note taking, like psychological research shows, is writing down. It's not review, it's just physically writing it down with pen and paper. It gives you really, really good like memory recall, like you get great applicability of notes
in school or university.
Reading them doesn't really matter, but writing them down is really important.
The physical act of moving a pen over a piece of paper is doing something for the brain cells that looking at a PowerPoint presentation doesn't do.
The next question is, what desktop window manager shell do each of us use primarily?
So I vividly recall this being... also an answer. So I use Zshell with like two plugins, the Zshell auto suggestions and what's the other one, Zshell auto coloring, where you type something and if it's garbage then it marks it in red instead of green, and the auto suggestions are just so great. Something you've typed before, it will appear in gray and you just auto complete this. Since I'm mostly on the Mac, I use the general desktop environment they provide. But on servers or personal, like laptops, machines, I had switched between Fluxbox to i3. And i3 is much easier for me because I can, you know, rearrange these in a similar way that Tmux is doing it, like split in half or split horizontally, vertically. And that's basically what I do. I'm not too big in graphics environments, even though I'm running them, I'm much more proficient in the shell. What was missing there? So we have desktop, window manager, and shell. Okay.
Yeah. So I just use OpenBSD KSH because that's a really good implementation. I cut my teeth on KSH. It was the Unix go-to shell back in the days. So it sort of stuck with me. From a desktop perspective, I use KDE primarily, but I'll use XFCE if KDE doesn't fit the use case that I have. But I'm on KDE right now as we're having this conversation.
Are you still on Plasma 5?
This one is Plasma 5, yes. Plasma 6 in the tree is just still like testing, and it's just like every time I go to use a feature, I go, oh, that hasn't been ported across. Oh, that hasn't been, and then I go back to 5 again.
That's good to know. I heard Plasma 6 landed in Debian recently and was, for my friend, a painless update, but I don't run Debian. I mean, I use a Mac sometimes, and I have as a desktop, but I for a long time used i3, and the worst feature of i3 is other i3 users see you using i3 and go, oh, you're using i3, and you're like, yeah, cool, thanks. I stopped using tiny laptops and have a reasonable sized monitor, and I found that the windowing was just wasting a lot of screen. Like, if I have a window which is half of this monitor, like, it doesn't help me, and that's the default on i3. And I started tweaking i3 so it would window stuff by default, and I realized that was the stupidest thing in the world. So I did what I do on a Mac, which is I took KDE Plasma 5 and I made it use all of my window bindings, like all the keyboard bindings I'm used to in i3, and so it's just like using i3. So I have all the keyboard shortcuts for moving stuff around, but I have a windowing, like a non-tiling window manager, and I think KDE is great. I turned on wobbly windows, and it is the most joy in my life. Whenever I just move a window sometimes for fun, it's great. Like
wobble.
I really tweaked the wobble so it wasn't too annoying. But I'm on a Mac right now for recording this because I've got to use this Mac Mini for something, and the windows don't wobble, and it's just underwhelming. Like,
yeah, we're easily amused this way.
My real window manager is Tmux. My desktop is just a thing to put 10 web browser instances in, but I use Tmux for everything. I found it really funny, so I changed terminal emulators, and I'm using Kitty right now, which is just annoying me to no end. And one of the things in Kitty was like, oh, don't use Tmux. If you want window management, use our window management. And that obviously it doesn't work on a remote machine, so use Tmux. I'm always on a remote machine. Like, I have remote machines running on my local machine, so I'm always like why have one computer when you can have 7? So I have a lot of computers in my computer. And so I use Tmux all the time, and I really like it. I'd like to turn off stuff in Tmux. I just never bother to. Like, I'd love to turn off the meta O, which rotates all the windows around. I don't think I've ever used that deliberately, like, ever. I should turn that off, but I'm quite lazy. But yeah, I think Tmux is the main window manager I use. It's definitely the one I know the best.
Yeah, it's pretty popular. And if you look at conferences, but people are
there's,
working
there's
with,
another one now that's cool, but I can't remember ever remember what it's called, so I just ignore it.
What, the Tmux ripoff called Screen?
No, the other one. There's some new implementation, but I like Tmux. It's fine. They fixed the bug where, they changed the behavior so that if you have two hosts attached, it changes the window size to the one that's interacted the most recently. And that was the main annoyance I had with Tmux, other than the windows rotating. Or if you do meta space and it shuffles the windows in some non-deterministic way and I can never get them back to what I want. But that's fine. Like, whatever. Just don't do the stupid things and you don't have problems.
We're coming up to the hour, so we're not going to get through all these questions yet again. Let's look at a couple of these non-computer ones. So do you have a non-computer hobby?
No.
End of story.
Yes, you do, Tom. I see your Strava.
Okay, so I run and I cycle, and I find it hard to call those hobbies, but in doing those, I'm using a computer. I'm using like a smartwatch to track my GPS, and I review what I do with a computer. And when I'm cycling, I have, my Wahoo, it's here. It's my favorite computer. It's the computer I thank the most. I'm like, cycling along a stop, and he goes, and you're like, oh, thanks, computer. Just says hello. nice chat. A lot of that comes from when I cycled to Sky in 2022 and being on the bike for 20 hours. It was my main companion. So I just talked to the Wahoo. It's great fun. Are they non-computer hobbies now? I mean, there's a lot of this time away from computers, but I typically think a lot about computers while I'm running and cycling.
But so you're doing a lot of reading also. That could be a non-computer hobby.
But these are all computer books, Benedict.
But is there also fiction in there?
We talked about books last year, right?
Talking about some of the books.
And a lot of those weren't computer books. So
I'm normally reading three books at a time. And so only a third of those are computer books. So right now I'm reading the second Expanse book again. I can't remember what it's called. Caliban Wakes, Caliban's War, something, I don't know. I'm reading Guards, Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett, which is great. You should read the RimWorld books if you haven't. They're just magical. They're literally magical. And I'm reading that security engineering book. I can't remember the name of, but it's next door. That's a computer book. The one you could kill someone with. Let me find the name of it.
Big Toe. Ask.
It weighs like 3 kilos.
Ooh,
it's too paper. Heavy. it's called Security Engineering. That's why I couldn't remember the name of it. By Ross Anderson, who passed away this year. The book is freely available. You can get it digitally, but I bought it physically because I wanted to have a book you could kill someone with handy. I read a lot of computer books. I don't know, like, if reading science fiction is so far away from the hobby of computers.
It is tech enough to be.
And I read on a computer, like I'm reading on a Kindle, or I'm listening to an audiobook with the computer, and I find it difficult to distance these things. Like the question earlier, like if you weren't working in IT, what would you do? I had to like think, well, I can't do anything with a spreadsheet because that I'd just be doing the same job, right? Like I'd be programming a spreadsheet, or if I was doing process engineering, there would just be so much computer involved. It's
You'd
hard
be a good
to get
librarian.
With. Yeah. I could be a librarian. That'd be good. You could read all day.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'd be annoying if someone wants to, reading. You know, get a book.
It's a very social job though. So we went to the library with our daughter. And I asked the librarians like the best query. They were so fascinated. They were so happy with it. I wanted Scott's poetry books in iambic pentameter. That's what I asked them for. And I was like, you have a library database. This is what you're for, right? And the librarian was so happy. She was like running around, like picking books out. She's like, this doesn't quite mix, but you could try that and this. And I was like, that's perfect. Like, great experience.
Awesome.
If you have hard questions, you should ask your local librarian. They'll have a great time. Or they'll be really mean to you and you'll get a great story. Like one or the other.
What are the two?
We mean all the way. Benedict, what do you do?
So I do Tai Chi and the sword form of Tai Chi recently. I started that. I'm not too well in that. I'm still learning a lot, like how to handle it. But it's interesting and it's totally computer off. You don't get any benefits if you have a computer that way. And it's a bit of, you know, move yourself. Don't get too, you know, stiff and completely immobilize. And I did a little bit of swimming. I'm also not too good in that, but I want to keep that up maybe in the new year to be a bit more regular.
Don't you find swimming to be the most boring thing in the world?
People told me that, but then they said you could have these underwater ear plugs that can play music, and then you could just run the laps back and forth because of the
like
music or podcasts.
So you get your reading in while you're swimming.
That way, yeah.
I used to listen
to podcasts while you're doing laps.
Like at uni, I used to swim like a kilometer every day, but in the stupidest swimming pool possible. It was an 18-meter pool. So
wait,
like
18? Isn't 25 the standard?
Is that some sort of measurement that was like imperial at some
point?
Yeah,
it's like enough space. 33-yard swimming pool or something like. Really silly size. So swimming a kilometer in an 18-meter pool is a lot of turning around.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of turning. You don't really get a lot done.
You hit the wall and you hit the other wall.
Yeah. I just find it really dull. Like the scenery doesn't change if you're in a pool. Like you just look at the same stuff all the time. If there's other people there, you are constantly frustrated. Unless they swim at exactly the same speed as you, you're either chasing someone or being caught like all the time. If it's busy, it's really bad, but if it's quiet, it's really dull. Like I have a hard time.
You need to find the sweet spot there.
You can go to a forest if you're running. You can't go to a forest when you're swimming.
So Jason, you're doing plenty of cycling, right?
Yeah, so I'm riding the cycling. So people that might have seen my Strava, I do cycling, but my discipline in cycling is ultra adventure bikepacking. So that's where you live off your bike for weeks on end and go from point A to point B over a couple of thousand Ks. So,
and you do that like a couple of months, not in total, but like
you're probably only doing one or two events a year because the time commitment, but also the lead up that's required from a logistics preparation point of view, so from body preparation.
And are you planning this entirely on paper?
There we go again.
I know where you're going with that there, Tom. Actually, I do a lot of stuff on paper. I actually pull out paper maps to do a lot of my stuff. I basically have a run list anyway, and it's just I print the run list out, and then I go and tick it off and tick all the stuff that goes on the bike. And then I know that if I've ticked everything on the list and it's all gone in the bike, I know everything is there. It's all catalogued, so I know where on the bike it is, so I don't have to, you know, days after being up for 20 hours and cycling all day, I sort of can find, I know where stuff is on the bike to get out and do what I need to do. So, yeah, that's all paper-based and that sort of thing. Well, I've got Garmin, but I do have two navigation devices because if one shits itself, you've got another one. So they're both computers. It's a Garmin 30X and a Garmin 840 that I have for that. So, yes, I do use computers for that. So
what do you do for inventory planning? Because, I mean, if you're cycling that far, you need to carry a lot of food and you must have to have a rundown for how you're going to refresh and where things are going to come from.
Usually the events, because they're unsupported, so you can't have somebody or do drops or whatever sort of thing, but you usually got a food stop every 300 to 500 Ks, and you sort of know how much water you need to do those sort of distances as well between those points. So you usually get clean water at one point, or you might find a bloody cow's trough over in the paddock there and you've got water filters and purification tabs, so you can sort of deal with that when you're out there. But food's not that hard. I've never really had an issue with bonging and running out of food. I always seem to have a little bit of food left as I'm running into the next resupply point. So, but everybody's different, and you'll burn, if you've had a headwind or whatever, you'll be burning through food before you know
it. Yeah, you must be super hungry then after such a stop.
Yeah.
Or at one of those.
Going to bed hungry at night. you try to have something as you winding down and trying to plow some stuff into your face sort of thing, because you want it to sort of be digesting while you're sleeping. But I hate when, you know, you have an event and your resupply point is at the bottom of some big ass climb that you got, like, that's going to go for hours on end, and it's just like, oh, you know, you need to take the fuel on board, but then all the blood's going to go straight to your stomach and you're not going to be able, and then you're just going to progress up the hill until half an hour later, and then you start to kick off again. So
that's certainly impressive to me. I would be able to get off my back to do at least one of those stops or to get to the next one.
You get to see a lot of the country. It's great.
Good benefit good to go around things, and have some, you know, scenic views.
That was definitely my experience of cycling across the country. Was it's the only way you really get to experience the place is going at a human powered speed. Because we drove back, right? I cycled one way and drove back, and the drive back was 5 hours, but getting there was 20. And I got to experience a lot of what the landscape is and what things are, and things which are 30 seconds in a car are maybe 25 minutes on a bicycle, because you've got to go up a 20 degree gradient, and there's no way around that. You just got to do it. There's no out.
Cycling is the best way to see or go sightseeing, because walking and hiking is too slow. You'll never cover the same distance, and driving in a car is too fast. You'll miss things as you're going along.
And cycling is just that sweet spot. Yeah.
I find that running is a wonderful way to make the world really small, because the distances you cover running, like, they're not huge. Like, if you run 10K, if you do 10K loops, you see a lot. But what it does is it compresses the world, because distances which you would think are a drive, you realize are things which are like 10 or 15 minutes away, but you just never consider that you could walk this far, because they're inconvenient distances to walk. Yeah. Like you might be walking for an hour or two, but actually they're entirely doable and you can cut it down. And cycling those sorts of distances, while you're on a machine, right? You have magic, it gets you there. But running is just all you, and you're like, oh, okay, actually these things are really close. I've been thinking too small.
Well, I think that does us for another Christmas episode. I've been enjoying a Bridge Road Brewers Beechworth Pale Ale while we've been having a discussion here, because it's well and truly 9:45 p.m. over here in Australia. But you guys haven't been able to enjoy yourselves. But being Christmas, it's time to get into the Christmas cheer.
Yeah.
But thank you all for listening, and thank you for all your support during 2024. We're nearly on 2025. You've had a great year, and hope you have a great year into 2025. And to Benedict and Tom and JT and myself, we wish you a happy holidays, and we hope to see you all in the new year. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. And we shouldn't mention, or shouldn't quit without mentioning, that you could always send us questions like these so we can have more for next year. It may be a bit long until you hear them, but it's good to have some of those. Also, our producer has a note that we should not forget to mention, because once we reach episode 600, it will be backfilling our Fireside website with the old episodes, so the ones before 283 years ago. Depending on how your podcast feed service works, you may get a bunch of new notifications of episodes, so don't get overwhelmed there. Sadly, there's nothing we can do about it, but we want everyone to be aware of that. And also, once we hit episode 600, we will be announcing some new Patreon perks, which is a new way where you can engage and get involved with the show. More to come in the upcoming weeks as we finalize those plans amongst ourselves.